This is CliffCentral.com.
Welcome to the Renegade Report. I am Jonathan.
And Ramon is present. And thankfully, I've recovered from being slap shitness by Jerry Mansfield last week.
You sound a bit nasally, though.
Yeah, I know. It's still the after effects of
Being slap shitless.
Slap shitless.
Because cruelty to animals or something.
Because jackals are pests, and apparently he found that deeply offensive.
And you should be allowed to shoot animals. That's
absolutely.
Also deeply offensive.
Yes, but including humans.
I think our guest today, we can have a good conversation about hunting, and a more reasonable one probably, because a lot of my views on conservation, for example, and how hunting feeds into that, were based on reading this gent's columns. So I think before we go into some long diatribe on our intro, let's just introduce our guest, finally in studio, none other than Ivo Vechter. Welcome.
Thank you.
The only... arguably proper journalist,
yes,
of the free market.
Who's accused me of being a proper journalist?
Well,
fine, improper journalist.
It's really great to read your columns week on week, where there is good research for the things you say, good fact for the things you say.
But my only problem with your columns, Ivo, comment section, man.
There is no more comment section.
There was one for a while, and then that closed down, and now there's no more anymore.
I miss it on one hand, and I think it brought immense value.
Absolutely.
Although you did spend many years of your life. That's not a flippant comment.
No, that was actually a real issue, that I spent such a long time engaging in the comments. I'd argue for days after the column got published.
Because you're a real, really genuine interlocutor. So if someone comes and, other than if they're just swearing at you, if someone comes and says, I don't agree with this point or you're wrong on this, Ivo will write a 3,000-word response in which he explains the data.
I'll go and dig into the academic papers and see why this argument is wrong or why it's right. I've had my mind changed on a few occasions.
My favorite comment section was when you basically said the state should force you to vaccinate your children. Yes. And all our libertarian friends came out and attacked Ivo in good spirit, if I may. I don't think it was terribly vindictive.
But I expected that.
But all the libertarians are like way attacking me, and all the letters are like, yes, Ivo, for the week.
Yeah, that was one of those sort of paradoxical libertarian subjects. Do you force people to vaccinate? And a lot of libertarians said, no, well, you can't, because free choice and this and this and that.
Mm.
But if you let them not vaccinate, then it's got a very serious externality.
Yeah.
And you're seeing today measles outbreaks in the Western world and so on.
Yeah, but it's only San Francisco. Who cares? They're all lefties anyway, right?
Yeah. Well, actually, did you see the US is considering? In fact, not considering. It's going to be on the ballot in September, October, November, whenever their sort of elections are this year. they're going to have on the ballot if people want to split California into three different states.
And what reason would they have for that?
Well, if you're on the right, you want to split it because the Dems basically have held California forever.
Yes.
And I think that's going to reverse in the next 30 years, 20 to 30 years, because it's basically a toilet, literally. But if you're on the left, and the proposal originally was from the left, it's a guy in Silicon Valley who proposed it, is to take control of the Electoral College. So it would split into three states, but they would increase both the number of senators and the number of Electoral College votes held by the three states combined. And where they're doing the split in terms of borders would still keep all three states blue.
So it's a bit of sort of supercharged gerrymandering.
It's supercharged gerrymandering, exactly.
But I read a headline saying that California will be a North Korean province if they denuclearize. No, true story.
What are you talking about?
No, there was a parody of an Associated Press.
So Kim Jong-un has offered California refuge from the tyranny of Donald Trump.
I think California is already kind of a North Korean province. I mean, you have to ask consent for every stage of sex. It's basically, I don't think that's much different to North Korea.
Oh, no, California is weird. I mean, it's one of those states where every product actually has a cancer warning label on it, because everything can, in theory, cause cancer.
Yeah.
And California now makes it, you have to warn people about that.
It's sad because it's one of those places that I think 20 years ago got as close as humans can kind of get to this idea of utopia, which is, of course, unachievable.
Is this the same time Rodney King was being beaten?
No, that was off. That was off. That was the 80s, Ramon, the late 80s.
This was the same state where Ronald Reagan was governor.
And what did he do?
Back in the late 60s.
He banned assault weapons because black people were carrying them around to protect themselves from racist cops. So Ronald Reagan, the great conservative bullshit.
The great conservative president, governor. Not governor.
You shouldn't trust anyone who tries to be president, I guess.
All right. Well, that took a funny turn. Well, let's talk about international stuff. You recently got the ire of BDS crew,
BDSM crew.
Yeah, those guys who
boycott, disinvest, and sanction.
Yeah, they don't like to put their money in Israel while they use their iPhones, their Intel computers,
and Waze,
and voicemail, and a million other things invented in Israel. You came out batting for Gareth Cliff because Gareth had made some comments about some violence that had happened on the Israeli-Gaza border. I think people can read your column. Basically, you went through what he had said and you said, look, based on what he said, there was nothing incorrect.
Yeah, he made a very good case.
I want to talk more about the response you got. And
the response was surprisingly mild, actually.
Okay.
I mean, yes, I had some comments from the BDS and, you know, people that said, oh, I'm supporting apartheid and I'm supporting a Nazi regime, mm-hmm. you know, and I've got no empathy for the oppressed peoples of the world and, you know, Gaza being basically a big refugee camp. And, you know, of course, they're going to rise up and they're going to fight the Israelis.
Cool.
Which, yeah, to an extent, there's a point there, you know. This conflict has got a long history,
sure,
and people forget about that history, you know. So, in almost no conflict is there a really clear cut moral case for either side.
Yeah,
you know. I mean, the last one I can remember where there was really sort of a clear moral clarity was World War II.
Absolutely.
You know, when you fought the Nazis,
and even there, it's debatable because there was a lot of, towards the end especially, there's a lot of stuff the Allies did in ignoring what the Russians were doing on the other side, because it was helpful to have the Russians attacking the Nazis on the one side.
Yes, indeed.
And so...
Ironically, Churchill never liked that. Churchill wanted to immediately move against Stalin after the Second World War.
It was only FDR who really loved Stalin quite a lot, which I find ironic given Trump this week.
Although Stalin and Churchill were great drinking buddies.
Yeah,
but the thing is, you forget that, you know, the you have to go all the way back to the creation of the State of Israel, right? And first question, whether or not that was legitimate, right? And you could argue that either way.
Sure.
But the fact is that this was a British mandate at the time. Several parts had been portioned off. Transjordan had been created. The French had Syria and Lebanon. Those were created separately. It had all been under Ottoman occupation. And frankly, Palestine had been under various occupations since the Roman days. You know,
arguably, Palestine as an entity
never existed. Palestine as a state has never existed until the late 80s, when it was created.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't want to get too much into Israel stuff.
But the thing is, Israel does have a right to defend itself.
Right? Sure.
And there is provocation on the part of the Palestinians. You know, when you're lobbing missiles at civilians in Israel, right? Expect something to happen, right? When you whip up people and say, we are going to march into Israel, we're going to breach the border and march into Israel and there will be blood, then expect something to happen, you know?
Yeah.
So you have to actually look at both sides and say, well, is this entirely unprovoked? Is this just Israeli shooting at unarmed civilians? Or was this in fact an attempt to breach the border and a hostile hostile intent? And it was.
Sure. No disagreement from me. And in fact, the UN today, I think, rejected a resolution from the US requesting basically that Hamas stop aggressing militarily against Israel and stop amassing violently on the border, etc.
But it's not only a US position. I mean, people like to think that the US and Israel are so close. But if you read the European Parliament, they've had multiple resolutions that call on exactly that. They do say that Israel should limit their use of force, that they should use non-lethal force as a first resort, etc., which they should. And frankly, I don't think they did in this case. But it also says that Hamas has a history of using human shields. Hamas has a history of provocation. They are an internationally recognized terror group, not only by the Western democracies, but also by Egypt and Jordan and Saudi Arabia, its neighbors. So it's a fairly widespread view, actually, that Hamas is a real problem in the area.
Tell me, though, when you write a column like that, because you know when you're writing something about Israel, for example, you know the people who are going to support you relatively. You know the people who won't.
It can't possibly go well, yeah.
And you know there's going to be some blowback. And I'm sure your editor must have said something to that effect. And similarly with other columns, do you find that it's getting better or worse? You've been writing for decades now. And do you ever feel like maybe you get through to someone that thought another thing and now agrees with your point of view?
I do, you know, and that's one of the reasons I keep doing it. I used to, back when I had a blog before the whole Daily Maverick thing, I used to issue what I called lizard badges because there was this idea that I was one of the lizard people, you know, with Queen Elizabeth and
David Icke. And
we rule the world secretly, right?
Now you're just a shill for shell.
I'm a shill for anyone that
Zionist shill this week.
I'm a shill for anyone that
now you're a shill for big plastic.
Appear to be defending. Yeah. Oh, I've been a Coca-Cola shill. I've been a big oil shill. I've been seriously. If I actually got money from any of these organizations, from all of these organizations,
if you were a shill for all of them, you'd be wealthy.
I would be extremely wealthy, and I'd be retiring right now. No, but I do change minds, and it's really gratifying to actually get comments back and say, well, you know, this made me think, and this made me think that maybe I wasn't right about Israel or about this or about that or about recycling. And, you know, 12 years ago, I used to issue lizard badges to people that told me that they'd been convinced after holding a different position. So it does have some impact. Does it have a broad impact? Very little. You know, I think on occasion I probably have influenced policy and the way people think about things. You know, the fracking thing I got very involved in, and I was very involved with the various policymakers about it. So I might have influenced some people there. But very often you feel like you're just pissing into the wind, you know. The ANC will do what it wants.
It just you know, it's this tribal sort of thing. It's the same with the show, like Ramon just referred to. We know, you know, who's going to generally react well to the show. We know who the supporters are, the fans, and the people who've been listening for a long time. We know the people who will generally react poorly. We know who our trolls are on Twitter and all those types of things. And what you really want to achieve, and one of the goals of this podcast was to get people to listen to a different perspective, perhaps.
Look, I think that I think I have achieved that. You know, I have put data and logic and reasoning in front of people and said, look, you know, you can't just, you know, think about these things emotionally
or superficially.
Or superficially, the
recycling one this week is a great example.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps if people haven't read that one, do you want to go into that a bit?
Yeah, well, Joburg now wants to make, from the 1st of July, wants to make separating at source, so basically separating your rubbish at home, mandatory in Johannesburg.
Yeah.
Which is kind of odd because it's only about 2.5 weeks to go, and there aren't really any particular plans as to how this is going to work. And, you know, people are supposed to have their bins ready and so on by the 1st of July. So I don't think much is going to happen. But
no,
it's interesting when you look at the unseen costs of recycling. Right? You know, people don't think of their time as wasted. They don't think of the fuel they use to drive things to recycling collection depots. They don't think when you rinse out plastic, which you are requested to do, who pays for that water? Who pays for the electricity if you use warm water? You know, this is basically moving a lot of the effort and the cost onto consumers. Ironically, this is going to put people out of work.
And bearing in mind, consumers already pay for example, refuse collection.
Yes, they do.
As part of their rates
yes,
and taxes.
They do. Right. Now, look, it's very inefficient to do these things on an individual level. You know, if I went and separated all my tin cans and brought them to collect a can, I would get cents for it, you know, if any. But if you make a job out of collecting these things, right, you get R8 a kilo. Right. So, if you don't have a job, that's money. And there are a lot of people that actually spend time going through refuse, picking out the tin cans, picking out the scrap metal, picking out cardboard, substantial paper, that they can actually sell to recyclers. You know, and there's a market for that, picking out glass.
Absolutely. And now the city are just fucking them.
Yeah.
So all those people that wander around with trolleys that separate everything, because I separate at home anyway, and I just give the bag with the recyclable material to the guy with the trolley because it's just easier.
Yeah, and people say the free market doesn't achieve anything.
Yeah,
people do that.
What the city of Joburg is doing,
you can motivate recycling perfectly well without making it mandatory.
Yeah, absolutely.
And without implementing it for things where it actually doesn't it isn't efficient anymore.
But there's no incentive.
Years ago, I said if someone doesn't pay you to recycle, then it's probably not worth doing.
Right. Yeah, I mean, the other point you make, which is excellent in the article, is why. As in, why should we recycle? Because there's this notion that, for example, and I'm seeing it everywhere now, we must the EU is trying to ban plastic straws.
Mm-hmm. And memes.
But we can get to the memes later. They're trying to ban plastic straws. They're terrified of memes because memes basically can lead to elections of people they don't like.
Oh, yeah, that's terrible.
So,
yeah. You wouldn't want people to have independent thoughts.
You can't have the wrong people elected. But they want to ban plastic straws because, of course, that is the great blight on Earth. It's like people have lost their minds. And then I see the other day someone in South Africa is like, no, Spur must stop giving small children balloons when they go there because, no, Jesus. I shit you not, must stop giving young children balloons because, you know, there's too many plastics in the world.
They pop and they end up on the side of the road.
They pop and then, well, I assume in this person's head, they pop, they go down some sort of stormwater drain, and then the cartoon they watched, you know, like Finding Nemo or something, they end up through a sewer and are straight out into the ocean, and then some poor creature dies.
Entirely possible. Entirely possible.
Sure.
And it does happen.
Sure.
Right? But now I looked at some stats.
Yeah.
Right? Do we actually know how many fish die? Do we even know how many fish there are? Right? There are a lot of fish in the ocean.
Yeah.
Right? As they've always said, when you know break up with a girl, there's a lot of fish in the sea. There really are a lot of fish in the sea, right? So when they come and say, well, we've done some studies and we've done some, they're basically anecdotal studies. They've extrapolated from there to reach numbers that are incredibly widely diverging. Sometimes you hear that 1 million sea animals die because of plastic ingestion, and sometimes you hear, well, it's only about 100,000.
And then even if it's 1 million.
How big is that in the big scheme of things? Right. In the big scheme of things, it's actually not that much. Now, of course, you want to minimize that, absolutely. But at some point, the cost of doing so becomes prohibitive.
Mm.
Right? And that's the case with all pollution abatement. Right? You absolutely want to have less pollution. Right? But the cleaner you try and get, right, the more costly it becomes. And all those costs end up in your consumer products. Right? You and I end up paying for it. Now, you and I might be able to afford it. Mm. But there are a lot of people, especially in this country, that cannot afford that.
Especially the people who are trying to jump from the lower class to the middle class, for example.
Correct. If cardboard is more expensive than plastic for packaging, right, which it presumably is, that's why they use plastic, then that's going to increase the cost of consumer products.
Yep.
Right? So all of this ends up with a cost. Now, how much of a cost can you bear? And people need to see this in perspective. Just saying that, look, 1 million fish die. Well, yeah, sure. Is 1 million a lot? Is it not a lot? And often it isn't.
Yeah, and especially what we got when we have people that, what was his name? He created a bacteria that eats plastic.
Oh, there's that.
Was it by accident? And then that other team.
There's a teenager who's doing that one, that machine, basically. It's a robotic arm. It's a giant, long robotic arm.
I think there are a lot of technical solutions that people actually overlook.
Yeah.
Right? They don't target the really sort of high-value targets like harbors and places where things collect, right, where you can have one of those wheels and so on, pick up all this rubbish. You can make a real big impact there. You can make a big impact by talking to the big retailers about their packaging and so on. Trying to do it on an individual consumer level is terribly inefficient.
It's sort of like after the fact.
Yeah, it's very inefficient. It really doesn't make any economic sense, and that's why they won't pay you to do it. In fact, why they will make you pay to do it.
I'm just not understanding. This goes to more of a government thing, but it's another DA type of program. You know, someone the other day described the DA as if they were basically at school, they'd be the hall monitor or a prefect. And
yes.
I think that is the perfect
description
of exactly what they are.
Absolute nanny status.
The EFF is the sort of bully who, the minute you sort of flick him, he goes off crying to his mommy. And the DA is without a doubt the prefect, and who wants to know why you're 3 minutes late for class.
Yes.
And there is no reason that this needs to happen. As far as I can tell, there's no, Joburg's not exactly clean, but it's not filthy dirty.
No, but especially.
But there's a lot of other things you can do about that.
Yeah, sure, absolutely.
Why don't you actually just tell people to bring the shit to you and you pay them?
Or, like, I mean, we've got
it's happening anyway.
Supposedly libertarian mayor. I know there's many debates on that, but a guy who previously showed libertarian streaks.
He's a lot less libertarian now that he's mayor.
There's no debate.
It's amazing
anymore.
What happens when you give a libertarian power. But why he couldn't just go, well, look at these guys that you've spoken about who are going around on trolleys, walking kilometers, tens of kilometers every
two
day.
Words.
What's that?
Dignified work.
They don't mind it. I've chatted to a couple of those guys.
Undignified, John. It's not about them. It's about what we think should be dignified work.
Again, the real choice is between that work and no work at all.
Exactly.
You know, in a country with 40-50% unemployment, effective unemployment, you can't be all that fussy about the kind of work people do. And if people do find jobs, then it's great, you know. I mean, hey, refuse collectors in the rich world are still refuse collectors. They still do that work.
Yeah,
it's perfectly dignified.
Pick it up was on strike.
Nothing wrong with having a refuse collector for a father when you're at school.
Pick it up was on strike last year for about a month. And every week on refuse day, a bucky came along.
But you know,
he said, you know, 50 rand of a bin. I said, oh, brilliant. Take all of them.
Yeah. Classic example of what happens when you put the government in charge of recycling is RDISA, right? Which I can't remember what it stands for now. Though it's a big acronym. They basically wanted to create the recycling a tire recycling industry in South Africa.
Okay. Right?
So they put a tax on every single tire that is sold.
Yes.
New tire.
Yeah.
Right? You pay 250 or something in a levy, right? And this is supposed to fund picking up old tires and taking them to recycling centers and then processing them into various bits and pieces, right? Some people make park benches out of them. Some people just grind them up and use them as filler in asphalt or whatever. There are uses for recycled rubber. So what happens is this thing gets established in 2013. By 2015, there are investigations about what happened to the billion-plus rand that these guys collected forcibly from, I mean, this is effectively a tax.
Yeah.
What happened to all that money? Now, they say that they employed about 3,000 people. Right? What really happened is that over that period, yes, they have copies of 3,000 IDs. Right? But they only have several dozen people that are actually currently working for them as tire pickers.
Right.
Those tire pickers then, right, because they were too productive, got capped in terms of the number of tires they could collect per month.
Oh, remarkable. Yeah.
So now you can't collect more than 750 tires per month, for which you get 2 rand a tire. Right? So they cannot earn more than 1,500 rand a month, right? Which incidentally is well below the minimum wage that we're talking about now.
That's right? Great. Even at that time.
So they are absolute poverty wages for a very small number of people.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, the managers of this outfit, right, sit in a 16 million rand mansion in Sachsenwald, which they use for their offices.
What is it with Sachsenwald? Is it just like between Bedfordview and Sachsenwald?
I don't know. Maybe it was convenient to be next door to the Guptas.
Portals to like corruption hell.
So now you're supposed to create this industry, right? This recycling industry and so on. Now, what they said was that, oh, for the first 5 years, actually, they were just trying to create a collection network, right? Which, granted, would take some work. Then they would look at the market opportunities for actually selling the stuff. So they're collecting stuff. They have no idea
what to do with it.
What to do with it? Whether there's actually a market.
There's a great market at service delivery protests. I think they're already being used there.
So what happens with most of the stuff remains in dumps. The rest of it gets sold off to China.
Right.
Who knows what China does with it? But
they burn it for fuel.
Exporting 80% of our used tires, I'm fairly sure, wasn't in the original Rhodesia plan. So it became a complete disaster. It's a waste of money. Half the money is missing. We don't know what's going on. The Rhodesia has been liquidated. And there's now investigations going on, including the Hawks and some criminal investigations, as to went down there.
Is that levy still applicable?
This is in the space of 5 years. As far as I know, the levy is still there, although Rhodesia isn't.
And the millions? How many millions are we talking?
They're questioning about 1.1 billion rand.
Wow.
So it's a lot of money.
But they employed 3,000 people. That's worth it.
And they achieved nothing. Yeah, they employed most of them for about a week.
So, I mean, if you divide a billion by 3,000, like it's a lot, but at least there's jobs on the market.
Yeah, exactly.
It's very important.
At any cost, create jobs.
Before the DA came into power, there was on the highway. On a Sunday, they used to close down the whole highway, leave one lane open, because 30 people are sweeping the highway.
Yeah.
30 people are sweeping the highway. I said, the amount of time and effort wasted by me sitting in this fucking queue, in this traffic line, by you creating bullshit jobs for people sweeping the fucking highway, that's unbelievable. And you're paying them bullshit wages.
I mean, I wrote once about the flag waivers. You know, these people.
They wave a red flag,
right,
300 meters before an obstruction.
Why do you think that happens? Because there is legislation that says this must happen.
Oh, really?
Yes.
You can't have a sign. You have to have a human.
Correct. Yeah. When you have a construction project, if you want a construction tender from the government on roadworks and so on, you have to employ X number of people, including flag waivers and so on. You know, flashing lights are no good. Right. Now, of course, a flashing light will work for $100 and won't go to sleep on the side of the road.
Yes.
Right.
And you can't blame the person, because that's a fucking boring job. I'm sorry.
Look, it's a job, right? So now you think, okay, well, at least these poor people have jobs, right? That must be better than a situation where they don't have jobs. But you don't think of the unseen economic effects.
Yep.
Right? Let's go back to Bastiat, 1850. The things you see and the things you don't see. The things you don't see is the money to pay them. Right, comes out of taxes. Right, so it's taken from elsewhere in the economy, right, where it could have been used differently and probably would have been used differently. Right, so you're reducing the amount of capital available in the economy. Right? That capital, if used productively, would have created more jobs, right, and more prosperity. Right? So you're diverting productive capital into creating unproductive jobs. Right. Jobs that, frankly, nobody needs.
But
it's like the old argument: if you take this to its logical conclusion, then you could pay people to dig holes and fill them up again.
Yes.
Right? And this would be good for the economy, according to that reason.
And they must dig with spoons.
Yes.
Not give space.
Yes, exactly.
Yes.
Give them spoons or toothpicks to pick.
Yes.
To dig.
That's how you should never employ a company that uses two people to dig your swimming pool or a digger. You should rather get a company that employs 100 people with teaspoons.
Employs 100 people
because
at 10 times the cost. And frankly, it would be better to pay 20 times the cost.
But government,
because then they could have
government loves doing
wages.
This. They do this with healthcare.
Yes.
They do it with schools. You wrote about schools relatively recently, I think. In terms of, you advocated for voucher schools, which we very much have advocated for on the show, and for vouchers just in general.
Yeah.
What do you think the... What's the problem? What are people so against when it comes to those kinds of ideas? Because when you explain it to some people, you kind of get this look on their face like they don't have a good argument, but they just don't want to do that.
Yes, no, it's because they only look at the immediate effects of things. Right, so they look at the immediate effect of a subsidy, for example.
Yeah.
Right? Yes, it's great for this particular industry or this particular company, right? And now they can employ people and they're now a growing company and everything looks hunky-dory on paper. But you don't see the effects on their competitors. You don't see the effects on companies that would have done a better job, would have used better technology, would have outcompeted them, but couldn't because they're competing against a government subsidy.
Mm.
You know, you don't see, again, where that subsidy comes from. It's taken from taxpayers. How would those taxpayers have used it alternatively?
Yeah, right? If they kept it for themselves.
If they kept it. And you can't demonstrate that either. Right? You can't prove there's what the alternative future would have been.
No, because there's millions of people doing millions of transactions every day, millions of choices. If you hadn't given
Telkom a monopoly in the late 90s, well, what new telecoms companies would have emerged?
Yeah.
What I find fascinating is, and I was having a discussion with a friend recently about some of this stuff, and, for example, the U.S. economy and some of the tax cuts that were passed there. And I obviously am pro those tax cuts, and this particular friend was against those tax cuts. And it's interesting because my assumption is that an individual will do better for the economy with their own money than the government will do with that same money. And the friend's assumption is the opposite.
In general, yes.
He assumes that the government will do better and that an individual doesn't need that money. It's just greed, you see. And while I don't necessarily disagree that humans can be greedy, the reality is that someone who has money wants to make more money.
Yes, of course.
The way you make more money, certainly in a capitalist economy or a free market,
is applying for tenders and getting taxpayer money.
Is doing more business.
Yes.
And that creates wealth for other people automatically, even if you don't, even if that's not your goal in life. Your goal is to make money.
My favorite thing about the tax reform was that all these corporates were taxes were slashed by like 10-12%. Mm-hmm. So they increased wages across the board. So I'm like, so
straight away, increased wages, they employed more people. They say, hey, great. We can do more now.
My argument was, why do we need a minimum wage again?
Yeah.
Wages were just increased without any coercion by the government. So why do we need a minimum wage now? No one was getting $15 an hour.
In fact, when you remove the coercion, the barriers disappear.
It's weird, isn't it?
Weird.
But I thought the director would buy a new Learjet. No, he gave increases to his employees. No, it's remarkable.
It's like the poster I saw in the Department of Labor window the other day, that said, a minimum wage will increase employment, right? Reduce unemployment. And I'm thinking, okay, so...
How?
So what you're saying is that labor is a Giffen good. Right? Now, a Giffen good is one of the very rare things where if you increase the price, there is actually more demand for it. Right? It happens with some luxury brands and, absurd things.
Old Porsches. Yeah.
You probably build a yacht, and if you make it more expensive than the next guy's yacht, then, he'll buy it, because he's Larry Ellison and he's got to do better than the Sheikh of Oman. But Giffen goods are extremely few and far between. Right, and they are studied because they are so rare.
Because they violate
every economic principle there is.
Yeah.
Right, if you increase the price for something, there will be less demand for it. Right, wages are simply the price for labor. Right, the price for labor acts just like any other price. Right? If you increase it, there will be less demand. As simple as that. Right?
Yeah.
But that applies to
everything else.
It's just completely illogical.
It's like, imagine the government set a minimum price for shoes. Less shoes will be sold. Like, it's not difficult to understand that point. But somehow, you increase the price of labor, more labor will be sold?
No.
Yeah, it's a very frustrating thought pattern, and it's when I'm sort of coming up against more and more often as I try to sort of speak to people and see what the way they view the world. And then I try to kind of see if I can put a little seed of doubt in there.
Jonathan, do you speak to people or do you argue with them? Because I know you argue.
It depends on who it is, Ramon. It depends. People I know well, like you, get argued with. If I don't know the person well, and this is the thing, for example, the assumption that the government has their best interests at heart is a deeply held assumption by many people.
It's a completely erroneous assumption.
But it's not even one that they've given a lot of thought to. It's just an assumption that a lot of people have. And then when you say to them, they don't care. Like healthcare, for example, there's been a lot of claims lately that healthcare is collapsing. The health minister says it's not collapsing. And the reality is, I've said to people, well, collapsing is a relative term because your assumption is that the government cares about the quality of healthcare. And the reality is they don't care at all, right? They want to
Ironically, they do, but in the opposite sense.
The government wants to be able to say, we provide healthcare.
Yes.
That's what they want to be able to say. The level of healthcare is really relative. If they're able to give great quality healthcare, then that will be a bonus. But here's the thing. Collapse is a relative term, because what will collapse mean? Well, in a healthcare sense, if there's still one doctor at the hospital and it takes 4 days to get seen, mm-hmm. and 17 people die in the queue waiting for the doctor, they will still say that the system has not collapsed, because there's a hospital, there's a doctor.
Yeah.
And people, right? are being seen.
Yeah. If there's 10 doctors and the queue is only 2 days long, they'll still say the system hasn't collapsed.
Yeah.
And so even though that system might need 1,000 doctors to make it efficient. So, you know, that's this assumption about the government having your best interests at heart, or wanting the best for you is one that's really difficult to get over.
But it's, you know, it's the odd thing that, you know, when you buy something with your own money, right, you care about both quality and price.
Yep.
Right? If you buy something with someone else's money, right, you care about quality, you don't care about price. Right? If someone else buys something with your money, right, you care about price, but you don't really care about the quality you give them.
Right. Especially if you're not receiving any part of that.
Right. And if you buy something for someone else with someone else's money, which is what the government does, right? They're buying healthcare for other people with other people's money. You care about neither quality nor price.
Indeed.
Right. And that becomes the problem. And then, of course, they run out of money. Right. So what do? They have to cut quality. Right, and that's why you see that even in rich countries, right? You see the NHS, you see long waiting lines. I mean, it's great for the people that don't have any insurance and, you know, get help for free. I mean, you know, any free healthcare is better for the individual than no healthcare. But ultimately, you end up with, you know, what the government provides gets rationed, right? Which means you're going to end up on a 9-month waiting list when you've got cancer.
Sure. Right?
Yeah, we'll give you chemo, but not now. Come back next year, you know, and you know, people die that way. It's simple as that.
No, of course. But what I don't understand, like something like a voucher, the government just needs to fund it and not manage. Yes.
If you, that's why I like vouchers. You know, it's. I mean, it's not entirely libertarian, because it's. You know, it's
we're still using coercive force to.
You're still using coercive force to tax people, and then redistribute that money.
Yeah,
but at least you're creating some sort of market dynamic. Right, in the sense that you're saying, people, okay, you can't afford healthcare. Here's a voucher. You go spend it where you want, right? At which hospital you want, which doctor you want, right? And you get quality that way. Same with schools, right?
Yeah.
You go. I mean, now you're stuck in this failing school, right? Where the teachers are drunk and the principal doesn't care.
And you're forced to be there.
Yeah. Right, because you've got nowhere else to go.
And that's where you're zoned.
No,
even worse.
The state zones you.
Yes, exactly.
That is the malicious social engineering.
No school can refuse a pupil from within a radius of 5 kilometers.
Yes, right? But if all the schools in those 5 kilometers are shit, and you want to go to a school 10 kilometers away,
they
by
are
choice,
not required. They cannot. They don't have to accept you.
Exactly,
and they often don't.
And so, as Ramon says, social engineering. Because if you're in a poor area, and your poor area happens to be large. Say Soweto, for example. Well, it's a large, poor area.
Soweto's not poor anymore, but yeah, some parts.
Well,
yeah.
Relatively.
And
you decide, well, I don't want to go to any school here, and it's not to say they're all terrible. But
no, some of them are good.
Yeah. But if you decide in your specific area none of the schools are quality enough in your opinion for your child,
mm-hmm.
And you want to send them somewhere else.
You can't.
You just can't.
Well, you can, but it's difficult.
Or you have to pay.
And you have to pay. You end up going to fee-paying public schools at worst. I mean, some people can afford private schools. And, you know, once they pay fees, of course, the school says, yep, welcome.
Yeah.
Right? As long as you pay the fee. But now, if you have a voucher from the government, right, that is worth roughly what the government spends on pupils per year.
It's about 20 grand a year.
It's pupil, I think. Towards 20 grand.
Somewhere around there.
Yeah. I saw Marius Root from the IR proposed 12,000 rand. Per year per student,
okay.
Which presumably is because there is still some stuff in the government budget that they need for, you know, to maintain public schools. I mean, he doesn't suggest closing down public schools.
Sure.
But if you issue these vouchers, then people can choose where they want to go.
Yeah.
And they can go to good schools. Good schools then get money, right? Which means they can hire more teachers. which means they can choose the better principles.
And they can compete against other schools.
And bad schools either go out of business or improve.
Bad schools either improve or they go out of business. And that is exactly the way the market ought to work.
And most interestingly, in South Africa, you can have a sense of cultural belonging. Because why do you have to be taught in English? That's a state provided, you know, directive to schools to be taught in English. What happens if you're like a proud Zulu or Khoza or Afrikaner and you want to be taught in your home language? Not that I agree with that specifically, but if schools compete against each other.
I actually think everyone ought to be taught in English in South Africa. I've long been right.
I think it's a good choice.
Right from the start, I've thought that that South Africa should have one lingua franca.
I agree with you.
Right, and that for practical reasons.
Even the Chinese get this.
Should be English. Right. Yeah, even the Chinese get that.
And remember, 20 years ago we were told, I remember
the fad
20 years ago was that we must all learn Chinese because we're all going to be speaking Chinese by 2030.
Yes.
And that has not happened because Chinese realized that they actually needed to speak English.
It would be much more efficient for them to learn to speak English. Look, I do agree that and there's quite a bit of study that says, especially in early childhood education, that being taught in your mother tongue makes a huge difference in outcomes. Right? So I'm quite willing to entertain the idea that maybe at younger ages they should be taught in their mother tongue.
Yeah. Well, I think good schools will teach you in English. Private schools will in this hypothetical system with the voucher system.
But it's entirely reasonable. Private school, if a private school wants to teach in Khoza, wants to teach in Afrikaans, I see absolutely no reason why they shouldn't. If they want to be a religious school, you know, teach you all about Jesus.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And if they want to be absolutely a flying fine. Spaghetti monster school, that's okay too.
I'm not going to send kids to that school, you know, because I don't believe in teaching kids that. But that's if that's free choice.
So what is it about politics that's about control, Ivo? In your years and years and years of studying politics, why is it so important for the state to control how people act, where they go to school, what language they speak, what wage they should be paid, what roads they should drive on?
It's sort of, you know.
What's up with that control? Because I understand it, but I just really don't understand it at the same time.
Yeah, it's weird. I mean, it's when you look at like libertarian politics and so on, it's always ironic that people stand to become president of the United States. I mean, they never do, of course, but and their purpose then is to actually make themselves redundant. You know, to work themselves out of a job. Now, of course, in that power vacuum of people who do want more control and do legislate more, you know, they just absorb that sort of position. Look, we pay legislators R1 million a year, right, to legislate. Right? We don't pay them to repeal laws. Right? To look active, to look like they're actually doing something for what they get paid.
They legislate.
They legislate, right? That's what you're paying them to do.
They
do the
job well.
Right? No, they don't.
No. By legislating, they're doing their job and they're doing it well.
Well, yes.
That's what I'm saying.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. By legislating, they're doing exactly what they're being paid to do. So the outcome is that you get ever increasing number of laws and regulations, right? And there's stats out there about the number of rules and laws that the average individual is subject to.
And the average politician, the average person who stands to go into politics is often a busybody. These are the type of people who see you doing something and decide you shouldn't be allowed to do that because it irritates me.
Exactly.
And therefore, they get into politics and now they will pass a regulation.
Or it would work better if everyone chose to do the same thing.
Yeah.
You know, we'd have more economies of scale, right, if we got everyone in the same sort of healthcare program, which is possibly true, you know, as far as that goes. But what they don't realize is that on the whole, it becomes a lot less efficient. And that you remove people's choice. You remove people's freedom, really.
Yeah. So my next question would be, isn't it better if we live in a deeply politically polarized society because legislators will never actually agree on anything?
Yeah, that's one of the arguments I've heard a lot. In some European countries, Holland, which is where I was born, as an example, I don't think they've had a majority party there in decades.
Yeah.
Right? It's always a coalition government, and coalition governments are inherently inefficient, right? Because they need to get other parties to agree in order to get the number of votes.
And inefficiency in government is exceptional.
Exactly.
It's what you want.
If you are opposed to government, then you should want inefficiency in government. A lot of people go, oh, but we need to make government more efficient. We need to appoint people who actually know what they're talking about.
Yeah. People link inefficiency and incompetence, and that's also a problem. So to give an example, in a South African context, the ANC government in Johannesburg, for example, was incompetent.
Yes.
And inefficient. Now the DA...
Only inefficient in providing services. Sure. But not inefficient in...
thieving.
Right.
Now that we've got the DA government who are...
trying to be efficient.
Who are trying to be efficient. And
but
all
are still
we get,
incompetent.
Yes. And now all we get is a whole bunch of nannying and rules and irritations as a result of that. So I think you want a competent government that's relatively inefficient at least
needs the consent of a lot of people with differing views.
Yeah,
you know that's
so that you can't pass stupid things.
That's certainly better than what we have now, which is a government where, frankly, if the ANC comes up with a wacky idea, right, they can go through the motions of public consultation and whatnot.
As they do.
But they don't have to listen. I mean, you know, I followed the tech industry closely for many years, and I followed many of the legislatory processes very closely. The number of times that they actually listened to input from the industry.
The NHR was gazetted last week.
Yeah.
Pretty much every
they can do whatever
every
they like.
Pilot project they've run has failed. Every expert has told them, do not do this.
Do not do this.
You don't have the money to do this, even if you could do this. They're not listening. They're just going to force the square peg through the round hole.
With the radio spectrum that is being freed up by the move from analog TV to digital and so on, they are now creating a wireless open access network, which is basically the government owns the wholesale network and leases bandwidth to telco operators. Of course, telco operators, if they don't own the spectrum, they only lease it, then they don't really have all that much incentive to capitalize, right? Because that's a much bigger risk.
Sure.
Right? Now, a wireless open access network has been tried in a number of countries, right? It has never worked. Right? Does the ANC care? No. they think that in order to get telecommunications to the masses, right, well, the government has to basically control it and control the infrastructure and build the infrastructure. Yeah. They thought that with Broadband Infraco, which was a government network that was supposed to give...
You know, it's mind-blowing when you say this kind of stuff.
It never worked.
No, but it's
the same. The only thing that's worked in telecoms in this country...
Cell phones.
We got a cell phone in the poorest people's hands. Right?
Without any government interference.
Because back in 1993, the government thought that Telkom was going to provide communications to everyone, and cell phones were toys for the rich, and they would never sell more than 1 million of them. Right, so those could be left to the private sector. They only issued two licenses, MTN and Vodacom, and those licenses have been much abused. You know, I'm not great fans of them. I mean, it's a cartel. But they did achieve getting cell phones into the hand of everyone.
Well, they've got penetration through, well, more citizens than we theoretically have, because I think there's something like 100 million cell phones in the country.
Yeah. No, I think the stat is something like 80% of South Africans have access to a cell phone.
And quite a lot have access to a smartphone, not just any old cell phone.
Yeah, well, that's a lot lower. That's a lot lower. A lot of them are feature phones.
Mm. Yeah. But
they don't have to walk miles and miles and miles to get to a telecom landline. Yeah.
No, ironically, I've the least regulated... aspects of the telecommunications industry works the best. I know it's a weird inverse correlation somehow for most people to understand.
Well, the internet service providers were far less regulated than the telecoms providers, the network operators.
Remember, MWM had a big black box like in 1998.
Yeah,
there's a memory.
But to your house.
But ISPs compete very hard with each other.
Yeah.
If you look at the fees that they charge over and above the actual bandwidth costs that they pay to the networks. Right. So for their own services, they're incredibly competitive.
Yeah.
Right. They're dirt cheap.
Absolutely.
Right. And they all outcompete each other for quality and for this. And, you know, oh, we're not going to cap you. We're not going to throttle you. Right. It's great. That gives you choice. And that's because the number of ISP licenses was never limited. So it was always a very free, competitive market.
The fact that there are licenses in the first place is ridiculous.
Yes.
But I see Vumatel has laid down cable all along Alexandria.
Say again?
Vumatel, a fiber provider, has laid cables along all streets of Alexandria. And
exactly. Telkom was required to do all of that, but never did.
And the household, I think the household pays 89 rand a month or something for like a 100 meg line. And that's bullshit because I subsidize those fuckers because I got a 100 meg line and I pay 1,000 rand a month.
Well, that's often how the market works, you know. I remember there's this great story about the foundation of the Mayo Clinic in the U.S.
Yeah.
People that say, well, the poor people won't get healthcare if you leave it to the private hands.
Mm.
In those cases, there wasn't any government healthcare. The Mayo Clinic was formed privately. And what that's what, exactly what they did is they used the funds from the rich to fund their poorer patients.
Yeah.
They wouldn't turn anyone away. Right? And they charge you according to your ability to pay. Right? So yeah, wealthy patients.
You're going to pay full price and more.
You're going to pay full price and more. Right? And of course, they had philanthropists and donors and so on as well. And then they helped poorer people. You know, poorer people paid less. And if you had nothing, you'd pay nothing.
Yeah. No, but I hate that old trope that, you know, people were poor until the welfare state kicked in. Churches and institutions, some institutions don't pay taxes because they were the charity provider for centuries.
Correct.
Churches didn't pay taxes because they gave all the donations towards orphanages. Okay. They created orphanages for themselves. They created soup kitchens. They created infirmaries.
Yeah.
These are all church institutions that were created around the church. That's why every town had a church.
Yeah. So there's no correlation with the welfare state. I mean, the welfare state came along a lot after the increase in general prosperity.
Yep.
Right, which sort of started in the beginning of the 18th century, mm-hmm. The beginning of the 19th century. Right, that's when a lot of people started becoming relatively prosperous. You know, and you can see all those charts that, you know, prosperity is sort of very low and then suddenly spikes in the last two centuries. And that's all Industrial Revolution stuff. It's all free markets. It's capitalism. It's the development of capitalism and free markets. Right. Before that, you had feudalism and mercantilism.
And there's a lot of talk now. I mean, the Enlightenment is a hot topic, so to speak. There's a whole bunch of people writing books on it. Steven Pinker's book. Jonah Goldberg's just written a book on that. So obviously, there's a lot of that feeding into it. Just tell me, because you're not a big religion fan, so to put it lightly, I think.
No, I've become as I get older, I grow more and more hostile to religion. In fact,
all right. So what do you make of the argument that, for example, so some people will say, well, the Enlightenment thinkers came about almost like postmodernists of their time. Nothing before them had influenced them. These were great thinkers of their time. They put stuff down and off civilization went, and along with it, all the prosperity we've had. And others will say, well, yes, they came up with great ideas, or they put those ideas, they sort of collated the human experience thus far into better ideas about freedom and about liberty. Mm-hmm. But that was very much influenced by, for example, Judeo-Christian principles and values.
I actually don't think so. If you look at a lot of Enlightenment thinkers, Voltaire and Diderot and so on, they weren't Christians, right? They were atheists back in the day. They couldn't really say so because they'd get burnt at the stake.
I think they called themselves deists.
Yeah.
So deism is a god, but he really doesn't care about us.
No, but they were responding to two problems in society, right? One was the absolute power of monarchy.
Yeah.
Right? And the other one was the absolute power of the church.
Indeed.
Because throughout the Western world, you had two centers of power. Right?
The Pope and the King.
It's the Pope and the King. Yeah. Right? In England, in the 17th century, the 16th century, Henry VIII combined them. You know, he became the head of the church.
Sure.
Right? But in most of the rest of Europe, it was, you know, Rome was the central power. Right? And it was separate from the King. So, but both had tyrannical power. Both were corrupt. Both abused the peasantry. And this is what a lot of Enlightenment thinkers reacted to. And they said, well, hold on a second. What about human freedom? What about individual freedom? And what about our conscience? And what about...
human rationality and reasonableness.
Yeah, and reason. And, you know, why can't we be productive on our own instead of having to be serfs to a landlord?
Yeah. Well, thank God the whole world changed after that. And today,
and that started the change.
Oh, it really did. It really did. And unfortunately, the state has replaced the king. But we vote once every 5 years, so it's not the same, you know.
I think, ridiculous. Look, I mean, I think in terms of that discussion, what's going to be more interesting in the books that now get written after these first introductions, and certainly what has become a popular topic, is the different sides of all those thinkers. You talk about Diderot and Descartes, but those were not quite in lockstep with someone like Locke or Hume, or even Kant. So I think the differences between those and Voltaire, Voltaire was a different kind of the Enlightenment kind of took two paths. It's kind of like French Enlightenment and sort of
the Scottish
Enlightenment.
Yes. Well, look,
I think if I was choosing a path, I'd choose the Scottish one.
Well, when you think about it, I mean the
thanks for the, what I heard that.
The sort of philosophical disagreements are perfectly natural in the market, in a free market, if people are free.
I know. Have dinner with two philosophers. It never ends.
I know. It's wonderful.
Or two economists.
It's wonderful, isn't it?
or three people in this podcast.
No, I remember when I read philosophy. I mean, I can't say I'm an expert in philosophy, but I did read some years ago. And I sort of got halfway through Civilization, and I thought, haven't they finished arguing about everything?
Never ends.
And it never ends. And then Descartes comes around, and he says, right, wipe the slate. Right, I'm going to start from scratch. Right?
Yeah.
What do I know? Right? Well, I think, therefore I am. Mm. Right? I must exist, right?
Yeah.
Which is reasonable from a philosophical point of view to take as an axiom. And then he screwed it all up by saying, and his second axiom is, I can conceive of a perfect being.
Yeah.
A necessary characteristic of perfection is existence. Therefore, God exists.
Yep.
But
also his primary idea of mind-body dualism, where the mind and body are separate.
Yeah.
So one is based on feelings and intuitions, the other one is reason.
Yes.
And the science says that's bullshit. Completely bullshit.
It's also interesting that in his day, if he hadn't concluded that God existed, he would have faced some very serious difficulties from the church.
Yeah, probably.
Sure. All right. So fast forward.
Anyway.
Fast forward 150,
we were talking
years.
About recycling, I think. And I don't know how we got to Descartes.
Well, that's fine. I want to fast forward and, of course, come to one of the great thinkers of today, Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
the greatest thinker ever.
The greatest. So what are your thoughts?
I don't like the guy.
All right. So fine. I think a lot of people. So here's the thing.
When he got elected,
a lot of people feel that way, but then they go from I don't like the guy to, but X, Y, Z.
But there are several buts. Yeah. Look, when he got elected, I thought, well, you know, he's kind of a dick. But I'm very pleased that Hillary lost.
Yes.
Right. So I was kind of going, all right, let's see what Trump does. Because at least with Hillary, we knew what poison we had. You know, we knew that particular devil. With Trump, we didn't. And he looked like a loose cannon, like he would shake things up. And frankly, any shakeup could probably have a lot of good results. He said, oh, we're going to deregulate this and that, which I think is great. And he has. He's actually scaled back a lot of regulations, which is so far turned out to be very good for the American economy. Mm. And then he goes and does things like he raises tariffs on steel and aluminium and so on, and declares a Cold War against Canada. And I mean, seriously, the Canadians are coming.
Okay, but you will admit that the tariffs thing could work both ways. So it could be his negotiation tactic, which could go horribly wrong.
It could, yes. I'm starting to think, and the North Korea story also sort of shows that kind of tactic, that he goes in, guns blazing, right, and makes it very clear to you that, A, he doesn't care, and B, you've got everything to lose.
Indeed.
And right. he's got the power.
Right. So he goes in with ridiculous demands. After which, right, he makes it worth your while to negotiate down to what he actually wants.
Yeah, it's called anchoring.
Right. Yeah, and I think that might be exactly what he's doing with tariffs. He's starting a great big tariff war, and then says, "Well, wouldn't it be better if none of us charge any tariffs?" Because he has floated that idea.
Yeah, he did float it at the end of the G7.
So I kind of thought, well, first I thought he was this protectionist, crazy, big government, mercantilist idiot, frankly. And then I think, well, now suddenly he wants no tariffs. So what's with that?
Yeah,
there might be a lot more method to his madness than you think.
If you read or watch Scott Adams, I still don't know if Scott Adams is a hack or not. But I think
he's got some good ideas.
Scott Adams
ones.
Created Dilbert, yeah. And he's got this like persuasion filter, and he's a hypnotist, and he knows how. And fuck, he gets a lot of things right. Mm. Holy shit. If you look back at what he said about Trump back then, and he says, he will win. This will be the reaction. In 2 years, within the presidency, they'll be like, okay, fine. He's not like, fuck Trump still. But, you know, he's done some good things. And then by the time the term ends, they're going to be like, this must be like one of the greatest presidents ever. And he also talked about his negotiation tactic. If you read Art of the Deal, if you read things through the persuasion filter, his own words. This is how Trump does. He smashes you in the face, and then he takes 2 steps back and he says, "Okay, let's talk.
Now let's do a deal." Yeah. Look, I think this is probably part of a strategy on a number of things. Look, on a number of other things, I still strongly disagree with him. You know, I dislike his identity politics, his xenophobia, you know, his sort of nationalism. I think those are harmful ideologies, and I've always disliked identity politics of any sort. You know, but the fact that he plays into that sort of the right wing identity politics.
Do you think it's avoidable, given that he's come into a society, an electorate, a country, and a world where identity politics is the way the game has been played now for some time, at least the past decade,
and in a large part because of the left.
Yes,
because they also play identity politics.
Well, that's what I'm saying. The left went identity politics first.
Yeah.
And I think some people might argue, and to some extent myself included, that you've got to get into the mud to wrestle with the pig. And you can try. You see, this is the thing I think some conservatives who are never Trumpers, for example, mm-hmm. don't get. They think that because they've always seen themselves Republicans, you know, we're the prim and proper bunch. We don't get into these pithy arguments and we don't do the identity politic thing, and we're better for it. And maybe you are better for it, but you're losing and you're losing badly and you're losing where it matters, which is in the minds of people and in the daily lives of those people. And that shows in the entire way your country is moving.
That's a good question. I don't really know whether it is inevitable and whether you actually should play up identity politics in order to combat identity politics from the left. I mean, I wouldn't think so. I would think that you can make an economic argument, you know, and you can talk about the working class and, you know, the whether they get a raw deal or not under the status quo, and say, look, we are going to get you a better deal. We are going to get America working again, etc. Without being xenophobic and without saying, well, immigrants are bad for the country.
The problem
is immigrants aren't bad for the country. They're great for America. They're great for any country.
I don't know what, for example, xenophobia you're specifically referring to. I would assume it would be something like Trump calling Mexicans rapists.
For example, yes.
But so, for example, that quote was not what he said, but even if he did call Mexicans rapists, you've got a president who before him said racism is in our DNA as Americans. So you've got the sitting president saying that you're all fucking racists, all of you. And you know what? No matter how much you despise racism and no matter how much you try to get away from racism, it's in your fucking DNA. You cannot move away from it. That is such a deep identity politic.
I think that's true to an extent. You know, that goes to a more philosophical level that can anyone actually be non-racist? Because we do have it in our DNA that we look after ourselves. We look after number one. Then we look after our family. Then you get group identities.
Identities are really important.
You look after your family. Then you look after your village. And you end up grouping with people that look like you, act like you, come from the same place,
share the same
sort of social values.
Yeah.
Against outsiders.
And good societies, you know, overcome those innate preferences.
Because it economically benefits them to do
absolutely.
So.
Absolutely. Right? And that's why America's rich.
Because then you start trading, right?
Yeah.
Trade was actually such a great motivator to actually reduce racism and xenophobia around the world. Because it was much more beneficial to trade with people than to go and fight them.
Yeah.
Right? And you see a lot of, you know, the more free markets are, the more free trade you have, the less likely you are to go to war with another country.
Yeah.
I think, you know, I want to push back a little bit against the idea that it's in our DNA. I think you're correct. Obviously, we are selfish in our nature. We do think of ourselves first in our in-groups. I just think the way we define those in-groups is very different and certainly up for a lot of influence.
Yes.
So, for example, the United States, late 90s, early 2000s, I don't think a lot of people were even noticing the colors of other people, because being an American meant that your in-group included people of various hues.
Yes.
And to the point that you were, inverted commas, colorblind.
Yes.
It just didn't matter to you. You didn't give a shit. Oh, right? Because the guy standing next to you, you were a white guy standing next to a black dude, you were both Americans. Yeah. So it didn't matter that he was a black dude. It didn't matter you were white. Yeah. It didn't even occur to you.
No.
And I think that when you ratchet up the belief that that people instinctively hate each other, especially in a country which in 50 years managed to basically move past.
Look, I do think that a lot of the argument, you know, the tribalism is kind of built into our DNA. Mm. You know, yeah, sure. But we also civilize, and we civilize ourselves, and we act rationally. Right, we think about what we do and how we relate to other people, and that goes back to the economic benefits of not being tribal and not being isolationist. I think we probably can overcome that. Sadly, a lot of political people, and it's a very easy thing to politically exploit.
Unfortunately,
You know, Julius Malema exploits it. A lot of people, the left wing in general, says, okay, well, these are the oppressed groups, and those are the groups that are oppressing them.
Are the Nazis left? Hmm? In your eyes, the Nazis, were they left?
Well, they were socialists, yes.
Oh, thank you. You see, because they were the.
It says there, right in their name.
No, but it's National Socialism, not global.
How can you say they weren't socialists? They call themselves National Socialists.
Okay, but the
Workers' Party, the Labour Party.
Agreed with you. And then there was. Where do you think the right part of that comes from? Because a lot of times you say to someone that, for example,
because
the Nazis,
it was based on ethnicity and race, not
and they're they're authoritarian,
which is why, yes, they were authoritarian and they were fascist, which is often associated with the right wing. It's one of the reasons why left and right is actually a relatively difficult or relatively not a very useful distinction.
Not anymore.
I mean, especially if you want individual freedom, or frankly, the authoritarian right and the authoritarian left are equally dangerous to you.
Yeah. And I had an argument with the conservative, the CP of South Africa, Andries Trinicht.
The old conservative party.
And I said, these are like the most left-wing politicians in South Africa. This guy couldn't handle the fact that, and he was a young DA guy. I said, no, but these guys are socialists to the extreme. They want to have these apartheid laws to protect white workers.
Correct.
Which capitalist apartheid was to protect white workers?
Apartheid was not a capitalist system.
Of course it wasn't.
Apartheid was
statist.
Was a national socialist system.
Mm-hmm.
And it meant to redistribute wealth from a bunch of white people to other white people. And
it was sort of trickle
and subject. No, yeah, I mean, that's,
and redistribute not to like the black areas.
But
like
half of the white population. Half of the white population had council houses and worked for the railways.
Yeah.
And the post office.
Well, that's the point of SOEs, right?
The civil service was huge, as it is again now, for the very simple reason that they wanted every white person to have at least a decent job. It was a very socialist setting.
Yeah, and that's why the ANC actually, I think that the ANC finds it quite easy to gain support, because they do exactly the same thing. They just turn the race, take the card around, in essence, but they're just creating a national socialistic state for black people.
ANC economics is very similar to apartheid economics.
And then now the whites are...
The economic policy hasn't really changed much.
Right, and now the whites are moaning that it's taking us out of the market.
It's better because it actually does benefit a lot more South Africans right now. Despite BEE and affirmative action and so on.
It is
a far more just society now
absolutely.
Than it was under apartheid.
Absolutely.
Right? Let's not start defending apartheid here.
No. I'm just saying...
That's not the point. The point is to say both are equally shit.
Both are
or not maybe
from
equally.
An economic
maybe no, not from equally economically
from,
yes
from an economic policy point of view yeah both are very similar.
Unfortunately, apartheid was generally meritocratic in the public service.
You think so?
I'm not sold on that at all.
Because they had a civil service that was quite well educated.
I mean, I was young. I was young in the apartheid. You know, it fell in 1990 when Mandela was released. I was 19, so I saw this as a teenager, and I heard people talking as a teenager. And I was mostly in Afrikaans environments because our church was Afrikaans and my school was Afrikaans. The number of times that I heard people complain about the lazy bureaucrats, all white bureaucrats, the lazy bureaucrats that couldn't get anything done, that sit there collecting a paycheck and doing nothing, being drunk on the job, it was common. You know, it was just how bureaucrats.
Yeah. I think just a simple example. People have always hated the licensing department.
Yes.
And 30 years ago, it was staffed by white people.
Yeah.
Now it's off by black people. The race has nothing to do with it.
No difference.
I actually went to the city of Joburg, the council's office. There's one white chap, looks about 70 years old. You know when they're a civil servant, when they wear like a tie?
Mm-hmm.
And everyone else said they like a leather jacket or they're comfortable. The black staff are comfortable. And everyone was actually pretty...
But this guy's old school.
And then this guy's like 70 years old with a tie in his... at an open plan desk with those very flat black shoes that Afrikaners love to wear for some reason. And I was like, you must be here for the past 50 years.
Yeah.
And like,
and you're as inefficient now as you were then.
Yeah. Yeah. And I thought, I don't feel sorry for you, but he was the only white guy, like in the whole building.
Yeah.
That's on the ground level that worked there. And it was quite fascinating.
There's a lot of, a lot of people you know, again, talk about identity politics. A lot of people, a lot of white people and so on, think that things were better under apartheid because services got delivered, the government was more competent. So absolute rubbish. They were just as corrupt, just as lazy. Look, they had it a lot easier because they only really had to cater for
servicing less people.
5 million people.
Yeah. Yeah. The other thing is...
So from that perspective, they had it easier.
Can government ever truly be meritocratic? Because here's the problem. What is their target? Their target is not the same as, for example, the private sector.
No.
If you're not meritocratic in a private company,
no.
You go out of business because you appoint shitty people to management positions, for example, or to front of house where you deal with customers, and they're bad at their jobs, and then you lose business and you go out. In a government setting, that's not what happens. So you can appoint bad people. Who cares? No.
And if your department isn't doing well, you say, well, okay, well, we don't have any money. Well, you know, in the private sector, they say, well, we have to work harder and more revenue because, you know, people voluntarily give you money. I mean, they're not forced to trade with you.
Yeah.
The government is completely different, right? We just have to tax them more. Other people will have to work harder.
Yeah.
You know, when you fail. So
let's talk politics now.
The motivation is very different.
Yeah, I think there's I feel personally in South Africa there's a detachment from the citizens to the politicians or to the bureaucrats. There seems to be like quite a lengthy road between the two.
Yes.
Do you think there could be a time where, do you think people realize the state is shit, or will they always say, you know what, we just need to make it better? It's like
people always say we need to make it better.
It's like an old car. You just need to give it a few whacks and it'll work again.
And it very
instead of just getting a new one.
It very seldom works, and when it works for a short period of time. You know, and they all fall back into the old ways, government getting bigger and taxes getting higher, more regulations and the economy goes for bullshit again.
Even like the so called greatest leaders of the 20s, like Margaret Thatcher, right?
It was only temporary, wasn't it?
And it doesn't last.
Yeah.
And she worked hard. She did great. She did many, many great things.
Yeah.
And it lasted, she left in
8 years or something.
She left in 79.
It was about 12 years for her, I think.
She left in 79, I believe.
No,
she became in 79.
Prime Minister in 79, and she left in 93, I think.
Right. And then Tony Blair won 97.
No, you're right.
Yeah.
Tony Blair won 97.
And he reversed a lot of the stuff she did.
And he reversed everything.
Yeah,
he made the English culturally left.
No, exactly.
And if you loved what Obama did, if you loved what Bush did, Obama reversed a lot of it, and then Trump is reversing a lot of Obama.
Obama actually doubled down on a lot of what Bush did.
Well, it depends on
healthcare.
Where you're talking
on healthcare.
In military, he certainly doubled down
on healthcare too. Bush signed Medicare, Medicaid 4?
Yeah.
Chapter 4. The most expensive form of Medicare available.
Yeah, well, you know, that's one of the myths that, we're gonna vote a new bunch into government and they're going to be better.
Yeah.
No, they won't. Once they get in government, they end up being exactly the same. They all end up raising taxes. They all end up with new laws and so on. They make decisions based on very, very weak scientific research, scientific principles. They are not experts in their field.
No. And wonky incentives.
What I mean, though, is that you can create legacy for yourself, but essentially that can just be trodden on by the next guy.
Yes.
And the as Ramon is saying, it's the government just kind of someone good can be involved, and there's going to be someone good around. I mean, the Western Cape for the DA is a good example at the moment.
Yeah.
You know, you got Helen Ziller, who did great work and frankly did great work for the party. You didn't have a party shooting itself in the foot every second week. You didn't have a party.
Although Helen Ziller was pretty good at foot shooting. After she left.
Helen Ziller became good at foot shooting when this country went social justice warrior, because Helen Ziller has never been a politically correct person.
True.
And she used a platform, Twitter, and she carried on being the same politically incorrect person she had always been.
No, but
and
she that changed became the DA. Unacceptable. She had to bring in identity stuff. She had to bring in young and black things to grow the party. And that's all understandable, but they fucked her in the end. They stabbed her in the back.
Sure.
Big time.
So the analogy or the comparison is, you know, the DA, which had a great leader for a good period of time, at least in the context of their party, had the Western Cape nailed down, and certainly Cape Town. And all of that seems to be unraveling because other people have become involved, and those other people aren't as certain about the way they're going.
But it permeates. I mean, you can't even point to a particular person. I mean, you can always point to the leader, I guess. Saying that, sorry, but Maimane just hasn't delivered. He hasn't been a good party leader. And I don't think he has. But it permeates the party. You know, it's been sort of lurching from one catastrophe to another.
Yeah.
One of the problems is, you say, there's a big distance between people and their politicians, and that's one of the our political system is designed for that. Although we elect people at local level, we don't have direct elections for our members of parliament.
Mm.
Right? So there really is a huge gap between you and the members of parliament. You vote for a party, right? And then your party will decide who's in parliament and who isn't.
Yeah.
And who makes the laws and who doesn't. So your direct control over these people is nil.
Yeah, which is why voting is a waste of time.
If someone screws up, voting at provincial and national level, yeah, you could argue is largely a waste of time.
Yeah, municipal, no.
Unless you care about the big balance of power, the greater balance of power.
Yeah.
But
do you think a party that actively tries to negate political power, hypothetically a party does come in and say, listen, we're gonna just deregulate everything and et cetera, do you think those parties will ever have a hope in hell? Because I think the propaganda has been so strong that the state is here to help you.
Historically, they have very, very little hope. You know, and I mean, in the States, the third party politics from on both sides of the spectrum, you know, the libertarians, the left-wing guys, Nader, the Greens, and so on. All they've really done is actually kick the election over to from your second choice to your third choice,
The UK is no different. Lib Dems.
No, exactly. So from that perspective, I don't think it's, you know, they'll get to power. I mean, frankly, if you ever think libertarians are going to head for power, well, you couldn't hurt libertarians.
Does it matter, though?
Do we
not need a party like the EFF?
Is there some benefit to having a small party, right, that doesn't aim for
I just need to correct that like the EFF bit.
For a majority.
Well, I mean like the EFF in the sense that they'll stand up in parliament, they will disagree.
In the sense that they will disagree and they will make arguments that make it into the newspapers and become part of the public debate.
Yes.
Right? There absolutely is a place for that.
Imagine the IRR, for example, were in parliament and Gareth van Onselen was an MP. And Gareth van Onselen, who's been writing some exceptional stuff lately as well. Yeah. You and him are currently my favorite people to read. And if he was making those arguments in Parliament, I think that even if he never got anywhere near power, and maybe he'd be terrible if he got near power. Yeah. I mean, this is the problem with the DA. As they get more close towards power, the worse they become.
The worse they become. In
because
terms,
they seek stupid voters.
Well, that's the thing. They need the more voters you need, the more you have to water down your message, exactly. And the more inclusive you need to get.
But like, so, I think Ed Ridge would be a better example. If every forum were a political party now, they would win 200,000-300,000 votes, 10 seats, for example. Do you think farm voters will be more of a priority? I think so.
If they banged on about it at every single parliamentary meeting, questions,
it probably would be.
Yeah. It would be on the national agenda.
Whether or not you agree with their position.
And to get them to shut up, the police minister and the police committees, etc. in parliament would probably
I mean, do you think expropriation without compensation would be anywhere close to parliament if the EFF weren't there?
No.
You see?
No.
How powerful that is.
That was an EFF platform.
Yeah.
6%.
A million votes.
It was a radical EFF platform. That, I mean, yeah, you can argue that maybe they were put there in the first place.
That's a good point,
as a sort of a vanguard for the ANC to test out radical ideas and see which ones floated and which ones didn't.
Yeah.
A million votes to collapse the entire country. That's it takes.
Tyranny of the minority. That's a real thing.
Yeah. No, but I do think it would improve the quality of debate if you had a more free market organization, maybe drawing some away from the free market wing of the DA, because they're sort of split between free marketeers and social democrats and nanny staters.
Yeah. Now, I think it would be very beneficial for the DA to lose power next. Unfortunately, the opponents, the DA, are like worse than the DA.
But yeah, so, I think we absolutely need a voice in Parliament for a freer economy that can make the case for capitalism and free markets, that can actually question research and research on which policies are based.
Yeah.
Like sugar tax, for example.
I mean, imagine a party that stands up in our Parliament, and there are none currently, and would go, social welfare is a social ill, and we want to abolish it. Now, they might know they'll never get that right in this country, because, let's be honest, no country has got that right.
I know what platform they have to run on. We will abolish personal income tax.
Tax is theft.
Absolutely.
That's not a bad idea
at all. Step on snake.
But imagine. who would disagree with that? Fuckers who don't pay income tax, so we don't care about them. But the people that are the most productive, who produce the most value, and who are the richest, deeply hate income tax.
Politically, I've always been very pessimistic about the idea of a low flat tax. You know, which is really economically ideal.
Sure.
Yeah, one tax for everyone, 15%.
But yeah,
I would disagree with that, though.
Yeah,
that's still a state taking your money.
Use a VAT or something that is easy.
Consumable tax is much better.
Sales tax.
So you take it only applies to things that are over 100 rand. So if you want your fillet steak, boom, tax.
Yeah.
If you buy chuck, if you buy cheap goods.
Good idea, yeah.
No VAT applies. If you buy a Ferrari, boom, 25%, 30% VAT on that. Yeah. That's fine. But you choose to buy the fucking Ferrari. But there won't be any customs duties when importing it, so it'll be cheaper anyway.
It might actually be more effective to do something that Milton Friedman wanted, which is the negative income tax, where you have tax rates that go from minus 20% to plus 20%, depending on how rich you are.
So you get a reimbursement, basically, if you're very poor.
Yeah, if you're poor, you get a reimbursement.
Yeah.
But in that sense, the government doesn't dictate how that gets spent.
Exactly. Government must just fund. If they have to fund, let them fund, but don't let them manage. It's very simple.
Yeah.
I think we should.
And that would be politically far more palatable than to say, look, everyone fend for themselves, because ultimately the outcome will be good. Yeah. The outcome probably will be good, but it'll take a while.
It'll take time.
No. And there will be a lot of hardship along the way.
It'll cause too much suffering.
So
we had a state where we sort of need the state, because without the state, unfortunately, you will cause a lot of suffering.
Tough admission from an anarchist.
Well, I'm a pragmatic anarchist. The state exists, whether I want to or not.
That P word, eh?
No, so am I. That's why I've always been.
Martin's is just having another MI.
That's why I've always been a small statist. I think there is a role for the state, and it includes actually some social provisions and so on.
Friedrich Hayek agrees with you. I mean, the biggest anarchist libertarians agree with some sort of subsidized welfare for those people that get left behind. Because believe it or not, science, I don't know how true this is, if you have an IQ of under 83, you are productively useless.
Yes.
In a capitalist society, you just are. And this is military, they did research in the military.
Jordan Peterson. Yes, I actually saw that stat the other day.
Jordan Peterson.
I'd be interested to see where that came from.
The military.
Because that's quite concerning, given the fact that I think our average in this country is below that.
It came from the military. It said that if you're in the military and you have an IQ of less than 83%, you cannot be taught anything useful.
Yeah.
Right? You are basically.
In a military context,
you're basically a grunt.
Okay.
You learn your drills and your cannon fodder.
Yeah. You carry shit from here to there.
Exactly. You do what you're told.
Because I don't know what you think of Jordan Peterson, but he had this wonderful explanation of so-called left wing, so-called right wing, right? Right wing, natural hierarchies exist. They are useful. They are maybe not good, it's not a moral claim, but they are useful, they exist, and they do a whole lot of good for the people in a society. The left hierarchies, they don't like hierarchies, but should it exist, people will get left behind. And we can't leave them behind due to moral, economic, and criminal reasons.
Therefore, yeah, that's one of the big problems I have with the left.
Right.
In order to not have stratification, they want everyone to have the same shit education.
Sure, sure. But that's why he says you sort of need each other, like sort of in equilibrium with each other. And Jordan Peterson says, if you got a low IQ, and that is not your fault, you are useless to the hierarchical system, to a market capitalist system. You will not provide that much value, so you will not get anywhere.
Not entirely useless, but you're certainly not going to be equally productive. Sure. And you need to somehow link prosperity to productivity.
And to leave you behind.
Because that's the whole point. We need to earn our living, don't we?
Sure. And to leave you behind just for something you can't control is more cruel.
Yeah.
So you sort of need to have a system that rewards.
And frankly, I've never seen anyone, any sort of private sector person or free marketeer ever argue that we should just leave the poor where they are and not do anything for them.
And I've got a very good example of that. So I used to work in many different law firms, and I used to travel around the country, but I used to work with my dad who sells mining equipment, for example. All the way across the country, you go to any office to deliver something, there's that one fucking tunny. Mm-hmm. He's 80 years old. He has no one left. The parents, the kids have moved to Australia. She has a pension of 700 rand a month from the state, back from the apartheid days. And she's there to shuffle paper and receive phone calls.
Yeah.
She would be destitute. And this is a charitable job, right? Yeah. She doesn't provide much value to the company, but they know very well these people would be nowhere if they didn't have a reason to get up in the morning and a reason to work and money in the bank. And we can provide that charitably by providing her with a job in abbreviations.
The other thing I like about charities is that they're actually selective and they actually fund what works. And they stop funding what doesn't work.
Well, the good ones. I mean, there are some really dodgy charities out there.
Yeah, true.
Yeah, I mean, one of my bugbears is charities in terms of that some of the wealthiest people I've ever come across.
Look, a lot of charities are
CEOs
charities. They exist to collect money. They don't exist to actually spend it.
Yeah,
they exist to enrich themselves.
A good
you're right. A lot of charities are like that.
And it's not the sort of mom and pop charities. You know, you often come across someone running a charity and they really are doing it in their spare time and they actually do a lot of good. But I'm talking about these sort of global charities which become household names.
Yeah, it's a slush fund.
You know, and they might do some good work. Medicine Sans Frontières is one example of an organization.
Of a crying African child on the cover.
Sure,
on the
and they do there is some good work done, certainly, and there is some funding that goes to charity. I mean, what was that charity recently? Was it Bono's charity spending like 10% or something on actual charity and 90% on everything else?
Yes, high. But when it's you probably 3%.
But when you think about it, is the government any different?
Oh, no, not at all.
I mean, when you think of government welfare, is of the money that gets collected in tax and actually gets diverted, how much actually ends up in beneficiaries' pockets? Very little. A lot of it is supports a huge bureaucracy, supports people getting very rich.
Like SASSA, whatever. Yes. How much of their money actually goes to the salaries and getting the money to the individuals on benefits? I wonder how much of that money, like I'm sure like 60% of the money is used.
I don't know the percentage on that. But
it would be interesting to find out.
But yeah, a lot of the government bureaucracy does exist for its own.
Oh, we've got a state employment fund.
It's own perpetuation and so on.
Well, it's not employment fund, but we're employing over 3 million people by the state alone.
Yeah.
It's
but if you're interested in charity, there's an organization called Effective Altruism.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, they've got these dedicated charities that they give to, which show... And they've got and
they rank them basically.
They
so they look at what their income and expenditure is.
Yeah, there are a number of projects actually that try to do that rank charities based on their transparency, based on how much money actually ends up.
Yeah, that one was on Sam Harris's show.
I think, and he was on Joe Rogan a year or two ago.
I think the best charity in the world is a malaria anti-malaria charity in sort of northwest Africa.
Apparently, the Gates Foundation is actually pretty good.
Yeah, don't tell the World Health Organization that they really have a problem with the Gates Foundation because they are effective.
Because they're doing malaria. The World Health Organization's job.
Correct.
That's why.
Correct. They're doing the World Health Organization's job.
That's a pathetic organization.
They actively criticize Bill Gates. For controlling the malaria.
Yeah, but you want to know what nannying, if you're a nannying politician type and you happen to have a medical qualification of any sort, you become public health. That's what you become. People who do public health are just basically nannies with a medical background of sort. And they are incredibly dangerous.
And they never admit how little they actually know.
Oh, no, and they extrapolate data. I mean, the sugar tax is another. I gave a lecture on the sugar tax about a year and a bit ago, and once I started looking into it, and the evidence that had been presented to Parliament was all false, basically.
It was
creative accounting with the statistics. The actual drop in the predicted drop in BMI.
I used the government's own research on which it relied, right, and said its assumptions are probably false, right? But let's assume that all of its assumptions are true.
If everyone comes true, right? 600,000 people lose weight, I think.
Then
I'm not joking.
Then, no, this will be the effect, right? Yeah. And this is how large the effect is, and it was negligible.
Yeah, and it was, when I say they lose weight, they go from a BMI of 25, 26, which is just
they go
over,
from exactly over the line to just below the line.
To 24.7 or something like
that.
So
that's like a 1 or 2%
weight loss. It's effectively, if you're meant to be 70 kilograms and you weigh 85 and you go to 84,
that is
the effect. Best case scenario
of
the sugar
if
tax.
All your assumptions come true. I was actually reading on the way over here. I was reading some stuff. They did some work on looking into the strength of the research on which the World Health Organization makes recommendations.
Yes.
And they say more than 50% of its strong recommendations are based on evidence with low or very low confidence levels. Right. So they really just make stuff up. They have very, very weak studies, often what they call ecological studies.
Which reminds me a little bit of that other organization, the IPCC. What's it called? IPPC.
Yeah, the International Panel on Climate Change.
Exactly. Very low confidence in results.
Polar bears will be extinct by 2013 or something.
But we all have to do this. Right.
Yeah.
But, you know, Abo, you talk about things like confidence intervals, and I imagine understand what a p-value is,
and your average politician goes,
a number needed to treat, for example, in medicine. And
I have no idea what a p-value is.
Relative risk, and
p-values are awesome. P-values can make you do anything.
So,
just depends which value you want.
Just statistical values that basically, if I give you a piece of data, a p-value says the chances that my data is correct, essentially, or wrong.
No.
And good p-values are less than 0.05, which basically says there's a very low risk of me being wrong on what I'm stating to be the truth here, the truth of my hypothesis.
Okay.
5% risk, basically. And so 95% confidence interval.
Right.
And then your confidence interval will come within a certain range. So if your risk of dying in a car accident tonight is between 1,000 to 1 and 2,000 to 1, that's your confidence interval range, right? And you want small confidence interval ranges, because if it's your risk is like 0 to 2,000,
sure,
Here, let me.
Okay. So the point is you have a sense of these things. I find that, yeah, politicians, journalists,
people who actually make the fucking decisions and write the news about it.
Let me give you an example of what they do with p-values, right? And then it gets much more complicated than
sorry, I'm trying to
understand. But if you've got a p-value of 0.05, right, that's basically 95% confidence that you're right.
Yep.
Right, that's 1/20. Right? Now, what they do is they take a set of data, right, and they run 20 different tests against it, mm-hmm. right? Simply by random chance, one of them will come out with the p-value that they want, right? Because it's a 1 in 20 uncertainty level, so 1 in 20 will come out positive. So here you have your positive result. You say, right, this correlates with that, right? Sugar correlates with dental caries, right? Bang, so there we go. Sugar causes your teeth to rot. We now need to tax sugar, or we need to limit sugar intake. When in fact, the work that is done on that is actually really weak. It's far more likely that dental caries is related to dental plaque. And therefore, that brushing will be far more effective than limiting sugar intake. Right. In fact, sugar intake might not do anything at all.
Right. But brushing is cheap, simple, and effective.
But
the government hates it.
And also up to individuals. You can't make money.
But there's also statistical ways in which you can, and they call it P hacking, you know, or okay. P value hacking, to get statistically significant results.
So they actually want the conclusion, and they just gerrymander the data.
All the time. And a lot of the research data is so called gerrymandered, in the sense that there's a big problem in the non-publication of negative studies.
Yes.
So there's thousands of negative studies, certainly in the medical field I know of, but
they
never get
published
all fields.
Because they're not interested.
So they find that X doesn't do Y, even though we thought X did Y.
Yeah.
But it's not interesting to have a negative finding.
Yeah. Doesn't get headlines.
And then the meta-analyses after 10 years don't include those negative findings, I suspect.
Well, it just depends how you write your methodology.
Then there's the other thing. You've got big data now, right? So you've got lots and lots of data about lots and lots of things. Right?
Yeah.
And you can go and hunt for correlations. Right? You can find random correlations. But frankly, the way you should be doing research is saying, all right, we're going to design this from the start, and how we collect data and so on. This is how we're going to do the analysis, and then we expect to find this and this result.
Yeah.
Right, let's see if we do. But if you go hunting through lots and lots of data, yes, you're going to find all sorts of spurious correlations.
And you can cherry pick whatever you want.
Entirely by random chance.
The more lawnmowers there are, the balder the men. So sell less lawnmowers.
Lawnmowers cause male baldness. Pattern baldness.
There we go.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. There we go.
Like, buying Ferraris cause male pattern baldness.
There you go. Like, for example, the AgriSA comes out with one study for the first time in 20 years, and they say, oh, farm litters are at all-time low. Are you fucking kidding me?
Well,
and then the media jumps on and says, oh, here's a credible organization that says farm litters aren't a big
problem.
But
that speaks to a bigger problem.
Fuck.
So you obviously write about stuff that interests you.
Yes.
Because you get to pick your columns, I'm assuming.
Yes, I do. Yep.
So you do write about stuff that interests you. I'm guessing that a lot of other journalists also write about stuff that interests them.
Yes.
And they may have specific agendas. And this
they do, and so do I. I mean, I admit that.
Yeah, I find that noble. So I think, as we do on this show, we admit our biases.
Yes.
I would... For example, the Huffington Post, we cannot get them to admit their biases. They claim to be a neutral news source.
There's no such thing.
No, there isn't. And so it's a toxic combination when you combine someone who refuses to admit their bias, although they must have a bias and probably an agenda, and they cannot properly interpret data.
Yeah.
And then they put those two things together. So they drive an agenda without being able to interpret the proper
problem
data.
Problem with scientists too. They want to find certain results, and they go hunting until they do, right? And eventually, if you look in enough data, you're going to find the correlation that you want.
Or worst case scenario, they manipulate it. The anti-vaxxer, the entire anti-vaxxer thing is caused by that.
Yeah,
manipulating data to show what you wanted to show.
Yeah,
one
exactly.
Bullshit study. Yeah.
Yeah. And frankly, if you go through the academic literature, you can prove almost anything, if you're willing to rely on only a handful of papers.
Yeah.
Or poor quality,
or poor
et cetera,
quality,
et cetera.
Poor quality, et cetera. So you have to go and look at the quality, and you have to go and look at what the other papers say, you know, and where the weight of evidence really falls.
Yeah,
but you need to know what you're doing when you read that, and you actually need to go and read the academic papers, you know, not just read what people wrote about them, not just read, you know, repeat things that you see on BuzzFeed.
Yeah, because some of the scientific reporting is like way off. There was one, I think it was like farts make X. And if you read the abstract from the study, it was about methane gas causing X, Y, and Z, which causes something else entirely. And the conclusion was, had nothing to do with the headline whatsoever.
Yeah, the message on pretty much when you read anything sort of scientists or doctors have discovered, whatever they've discovered, is to take it with like at least like a tablespoon.
I would say
salt, but sugar.
How many cures for cancer? How many cures for cancer have they developed?
Well, the thing
every
is,
week there's a new cure.
I
for
can
cancer.
Tell you, I read medical papers, scientific papers all the time, and the reality is that there's no such thing as a groundbreaking paper. We find things in small baby steps.
Yes.
And then after 20 years of research, we combine all of those baby steps into something.
Yeah.
Cancer treatment, as one example, is 60, 70, 80 years of research now where we finally got to the point where we're actually doing really well against most cancers.
I think so too,
we've
actually
pushed a lot of cancer back. Again, there were cancers
but almost all the headlines that say, oh, they found that this influences cancer and this influences cancer.
Well, marijuana cures it, doesn't it?
Right. Exactly. Marijuana, great example. And almost all of those headlines are false.
Yep.
Right. It simply doesn't work that way.
Clickbait, you know? Right?
Just because you've managed to put some chemical in a petri dish and it acted against a cancer cell in that petri dish, right, does not mean that you have a cure for cancer.
No, the human body is far too complicated.
It doesn't work that way.
To do that.
Yeah.
Gentlemen.
Anyway.
Well, Ivo, we've set a record.
Yeah.
Have we?
Really?
We have.
I talk too much, don't I?
No, you don't at all. This has been a fantastic conversation.
I really want to go 3 hours one day.
Well,
when we've got the time and it's not 6:45 in the evening.
We've done an hour and 40 odd minutes. So
oh, wow.
That's pretty good.
Probably time to wrap up.
See,
then.
It was time to get you in studio.
Yeah. When are you? Well, don't tell.
We can do this.
How's Nasna after the fire and everything?
Oh, getting there. Not happy with the government response, of course.
Yeah.
That's why we fired our mayor the other day. now the DA wants to fire the new mayor because DA is not happy with how the old mayor got fired.
The grand wizards weren't consulted, John.
So, there's a lot of ups and downs.
Well, as long as the new mayor doesn't say they're friends with Israel, then everything will be fine.
But in general, the town is recovering. You can still see the scars. And, of course, there's a lot of effects that will take very long to heal. You know, you lose about 1,000 homes or so. That doesn't fix itself overnight.
Especially in a town that's full.
Especially in a town that's full and relies on tourism, you know. Indeed. I mean, when the fires happened, everyone cancelled the Oyster Festival bookings to put up people that were displaced. But, of course, by Christmas, they couldn't afford to do so. So by Christmas, we still had people living in tents on the high school fields. There's a lot that still needs to. But the town has been pulling together, and it's recovering.
Reception by private aid organizations that came in and actually like solved a lot of the issues phenomenal.
Yeah, I thought the reactions of private aid organizations were awesome. I'm not very pleased with how the municipality handled all those donations.
Sure.
A lot of people pulled together during those fires. It was, in a way, it was very touching to see how much people were willing to sacrifice in order to help people in trouble.
Yeah, and unfortunately, we need like that level of suffering to actually have a common goal.
Yeah,
sometimes.
Unfortunately,
sometimes.
Yeah. Good to hear. It's fantastic.
But it gives you hope for the human spirit, you know.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
What a pleasure, sir. Thank you for coming.
Great conversation. If you're not a little bit more libertarian after that, well, I don't know what's wrong with you.
And less sure about scientific studies. wasted an hour and 40 minutes.
Please do find Ivo on Twitter at Ivo Vechter. And please do read his columns every single week on a Tuesday.
Every Tuesday on Daily Maverick, yeah.
And well-researched, very insightful, lots of fact. The stuff we really want from our journalism.
Right. And if there's somehow a column in the near future that says podcasts are the best way to get messages across, we did not fund it.
Just but we to you heavily know. Support that.
But we will heavily subsidize it.
Right. So enough of podcast shilling. If you would like to follow us at Renegade_Report on Twitter, you can find us on Facebook, both the page and Renegade Report group, to have interesting discussions around all kinds of topics in the world and on the podcast. We really do appreciate you listening to us this week. If you enjoyed the podcast, you're always welcome to donate on Patreon. Thanks so much. Catch you next time. Cheers.
This is CliffCentral.com.